And Fort Bend ISD officials say it's still too early to know just who is buried here. But the Sugar Land man says he believes he knows, and he says it's something he's been working to get acknowledged for nearly 20 years. Retired state corrections officer and now historian Reginald Moore is the caretaker of this small cemetery on the grounds of what used to be the Imperial Farm Prison.
This was a segregated prison.
Moore says some of the men buried here were part of the convict lease system created in Texas just after slavery was outlawed.
The system said you were free unless convicted of a crime, and so that's how they was able to get slavery back.
Okay, we're back, everybody. It's Two Stonians, Jorge and Joe. We're joined today by my good friend Maria, who is an old friend of mine from grad school. She is an activist, a fellow educator, an all-around kick-ass person. And we are here to talk about, largely we're going to talk about historical memory, and particularly things about civil rights, lynching memorials, and things of this nature. But first, Maria, after years of haranguing on my part, finally, because she lives in Louisiana now. I knew her when she lived in Connecticut. Before that, you were in Pennsylvania, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I have been haranguing her for years to go see Houston. Of course, she goes when I can't go, right? Which feels like a deliberate attack on my character, you know? But I wanted to hear about it. Tell us why you were there. Tell us what you did. Did you take any of my food recommendations? And what you thought of our city? Just start broadly, and we'll just riff off that.
Yeah, I went, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. It was my first time ever in Houston outside of the airport. And it was absolutely fantastic. It did not get started on a great foot because Houston, I guess, is notorious for traffic. Took me a while to get into the city. But I did take your recommendation, and I stayed in the Heights, which was a pretty cool, if rapidly gentrifying or gentrified neighborhood.
And that's where I live.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. Yeah. I stayed at a beautiful, like, family-run B&B, and I had several great meals and a lot of wine. I went to sort of a classic Texas steakhouse. I went to a barbecue place. I got really good tacos every day. I was there.
You gotta tell us where you went. You gotta say where.
Name drop.
I stayed mostly in the Heights, and I took a lot of your recommendations and other people's recommendations for what's in the Heights. But I guess the first night I was there, I went to this place called something. It's like a seafood something in sand or shore. I got like they have this huge gumbo dish. I didn't get it, but that's like what they're known for.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, not off the top of my head.
It was really, really dope. Every place,
maybe, or
I will look it up and send it to you. I should have Yelped, but I Instagrammed a lot of my food.
Oh, I know. I was following you and resentfully following your travails.
I think what was like my favorite part of Houston, I mean, besides the food, like I was by myself. So literally every bar I went to, people would just like saddle up and talk to you. Like it reminded me a lot of Ireland in that way. Like people were just like buying me drinks and like, where are you from? And like, you know, telling me about how they got to Houston. I met a lot of transplants, what they did in Houston. And so that was really cool. It kind of had a Midwest vibe, even though it's not in the Midwest.
I feel like using the phrase saddle up is a pander, and it's working.
It was really, really fun. And I spent a lot of time at Rice, which is like a really beautiful campus in a different area of town. And what's really cool about Rice, I mean, the reason I was there was to do research on the Sugar Land victims that they uncovered about a year ago. And Rice has put a lot of time and resources into honoring the local activists that are working on that project, which is really cool because they're a private university, and so they sort of probably do what they want.
I interviewed for a job at Rice. I was a runner-up. I didn't get it, obviously, because I'm still out here. But
one of the things they said, I'm almost quoting when they were talking about like programming and salary and stuff like that. And they were very clear, like, this is Rice. If the problem is money, there's no problem.
Right. Right.
They basically said exactly that to me.
Yeah. I mean, they put on this awesome program. So, I guess I should give context. So the 95 victims they found at Sugarland were uncovered when they were building a
Hold up. I'm going to pause you. Okay. I have not had enough scotch yet to talk about unmarked graves. So let's go back to tacos and steak just for a few minutes.
Yeah. I'm going to look up the name of that restaurant.
Yeah. I like what you said earlier about how friendly Houston is. Like, I bring a lot of people to Houston, as Joe can attest to, and I get that same comment. In fact, I was reading like a Forbes article or something, and somebody said that Houston's character is somebody, it's like everybody there is laid back and up for whatever. Like, they'll try anything, kind of a try anything twice town is what I always call it. And it's very affirming to hear other people say the same thing, especially because I'm stuck out here in Massachusetts where nobody talks to anybody. Like, nobody is I don't think anybody even has friends out here. People sort of resent friendship out here in a weird way, and it just makes you really miss the South.
It's true. Having lived in Louisiana for 2 years, it seemed really similar to Louisiana. Like, this is the most friends I've ever had outside of the university or the academy has been here living in Louisiana. And it's because it's pretty much impossible not to meet people. One of my best friends I met in the bathroom when I was on a really terrible Tinder date. I met another girl online at the grocery store, and she invited me over for dinner. Like, people are just very friendly in the South, and it's a little disarming. Okay, so I had a chance to look at my notes / Instagram feed. Houston restaurants. Field and Tides was the place I went to.
Oh, have you been there? Okay.
Yeah.
I have not.
It was good. And I went, I have a soft spot in my heart for Torchy's, but when I went, I could tell that that's a controversial opinion.
Well, Torchy's, it started as a small food truck in Austin.
Uh-huh.
Sort of just expanded. It's sort of become just like casual fast food here. Where it used to be kind of a special thing.
Yeah.
So people are just kind of sick of it. And they're also sick of, like, that sort of industry is really popular here now.
Yeah.
It's like the fancy tacos where you're, like, where in Houston you used to be able to get the best tacos in the world for $2
and
$5 for it.
Yeah. It seems like they're kind of like white people tacos, you know, now. They're just like, what can we fry and put on a taco?
White people tacos are hot dogs, all right?
Old El Paso or something, you know?
I will not have Torchy's slandered by being called white people tacos, even if it is from Austin and it's 75% white city.
So you like Torchy's?
I love the
More than 75% now.
Yeah, right.
Good thing Amazon didn't go there. It'd have been the rest of the percentage.
I'm so thankful.
I love the Torchy sauce. Hot sauce is the best sauce I've encountered for multiple reasons. Like, it's creamy, which you don't see very many good creamy sauces that aren't just mayonnaise.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And this fucking who's someone who likes mayonnaise, and I'm just like, oh, this is too much mayonnaise. But it's just like creamy, and it's like 5 calories per serving.
Yeah,
got, like, nothing weird in it. It's just a fantastic sauce. And Joe's right. That's sort of like fusion-y. There's thyme and rosemary on this taco. Woo! You know that shit is pretty cliche in Houston, especially the fusion style, because Houston just loves fusion generally.
Yeah.
But with that being said, I don't know. I guess I have a soft spot for Torchy's that just never went away.
Yeah. I mean, I get nostalgic for it, too, because when I used to visit Fort Worth a lot, it was like I was living in an area of the country that didn't have tacos at all. And so it was like, oh, my God, Torchy's, queso, guacamole. That's actually made with avocados. But when I went, the Masters were on, I think the Masters or whatever Tiger Woods was playing in. And there was this group of guys that was like just out of college that go there every Saturday. And somehow I was like in the middle of their group at the bar. And so I was basically just watching the Masters with them most of Saturday. And they were like, just watch the Masters with us. We always watch golf here on Saturday and Sunday. And they knew all the bartenders. And like, so it seemed like a local spot, even though it's kind of like a chain now, right? If that makes sense.
I love two things about your story. First, one, it's both the lamest story and the best. Because first of all, being friends with strangers, but watching golf every Saturday, that sounds more boring than playing golf. And secondly, I love the low-key Fort Worth slam that you opened that story. Because shitting on Dallas always flies on Houstonians. Like, this episode might have been brought to you by dumping on Dallas.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Fort Worth did not have a lot of highlights in general. Still doesn't. but Torchy's was one. The thing about Fort Worth, too, is, like, the weather isn't even good. It's not like Houston where you're like, oh, my God, it's November. It's beautiful. It's, like, November and it's fucking cold. And then it's July and it's fucking hot. And there's no, like, nice season in Fort Worth and Dallas the way there is in Houston and South Louisiana.
Oh, I agree that Fort Worth and Dallas has no redeeming qualities.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, did you get to check out any, like, what did you get to check out anything other than food? I mean, obviously you could spend weeks just eating in Houston.
I shopped a little bit because there was a music festival here in South Louisiana called Festival International, which is like sort of our claim to fame. It happens the same week as New Orleans Jazz Fest for some reason I can't explain. And so I needed festival clothes because, as you know, I'm not really a bohemian chic type. So I walked into this store in the Heights and I was like, I'm going to a music festival. And these like beautiful women were like, let us help you. And they were like throwing flowy clothes at me. And I was like, this is perfect. So it was actually a lot of fun. I looked at like some antiques in some bookstores and some clothing stores in the Heights. And
sounds like you were on 19th Street for all this.
Yeah, that's what that sounds like.
Yeah.
That's where Torchy's is. So that's sounds like 19th.
Yeah, there's a Torchy's on the corner,
Man, I grew up around the corner from there. Yeah, my mom still lives in the Heights. I grew up in the Heights in the 80s. Like, we moved into the Heights when, like, 82, when the Heights was still, you know, the hood, right? It's not anymore. I don't know if I've told this story on the pod. I'll tell it to you anyway, just to give you an idea of how crazy, we'll say gentrified, anyway. So, walking down the street, me and a buddy of mine, we were, like, I want to say 16, 17, something like that, right? And we were walking down the street to this McDonald's, right? That was just open 24 hours to get some food. And there was this just shady house on the street that always had people there at night, you know? Yeah. Never there in the day. So it was always like, we were always like, I bet you they sell weed there, you know? And so we went. We're like, all right, finally, we asked the big dude at the front, like, hey, y'all got any weed? And they were like, nah, but we got crack. First one free. And my first thought was like, they really say that. They really say the first one's free. Like, I couldn't believe it. And we just kept going. We're like, nah, we're good. We're good. We just kept going. That building is now like an expensive beauty salon.
Right. Right.
And next door is a bail bondsman. So it feels like there's still some vestiges of the old culture.
I mean,
also how foolproof track is. You just give the first one away and you know they'll...
I can't think of any other product that you do that with. Like, what's the other thing you give someone away the first one? You'll be back.
You'll be back.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I'm going down in Louisiana. Baby, behind the sun. I'm going down to Louisiana. Honey, behind.
Let's talk about the Sugar Land Project then.
Yeah.
Joe, you've been wanting to talk about this a lot, right? Put it off. Well, you want to go ahead and want to start us off?
I work in the area. So the Sugarland 95, I do a lot of business with Fort Bend ISD. Mm. So the Sugarland 95 has been a big story in the area. Fort Bend Star has done a lot of reporting on it. And we were reading the Texas Monthly article on it. But I want you to talk about it a little bit more because I think you have more information about it.
Yeah, well, I sort of stumbled upon it when I was writing an article about a 19th century novel about convict leasing that's set actually in West Virginia, and it's sort of a take on the Tennessee coal and iron miners' strike of the late 19th century, which is basically the strike where some white wage-laboring miners, most of whom were white immigrants, ended up emancipating, freeing convict laborers, mostly black convict laborers, who were competing obviously in terms of their own wages, because they were also coal miners. And they sent them on this train out of town, basically as a tactic against the union busting that they were facing from Tennessee Coal and Iron, which anyway, the novel reimagines this as like an act of radical worker solidarity rather than an act of self-interest on the part of the white immigrant miners. And so I was trying to think about convict labor in a contemporary context. And obviously, you know, convict labor and mass incarceration is different. But I stumbled across the Sugarland 95, who had gotten some mainstream press coverage, but not nearly as much as I thought, considering how underappreciated convict labor is as a historical phenomenon in American culture. And so I did a little bit of digging and realized that the main activist around this issue, Reggie Moore, he actually is a graduate of a university in South Louisiana. He played football here, and he's from this area. And he got interested in the convict labor system in Texas because he was a prison guard in the 70s and the 80s during the war on drugs. And he essentially has become a professional historian after retiring from this industry. And he suspected before they started building that school in Sugarland that they were going to uncover an unmarked grave. And he was exactly right. 95 victims, one female. The youngest victim was probably about 14. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of the archaeologists so far have said that it seems like many of the victims were probably formerly enslaved and put to work in the convict labor system after emancipation.
So just for some additional context, if you don't mind me interrupting you,
yeah.
For those at home who may not know, because the three of us have talked about this, so we know convict right. labor is something that happens after emancipation. It happens largely at the turn of the century. It doesn't, as an era, it doesn't last long. So one of the things that sort of overshadowed this, of course, is the 13th Amendment, which forbids slavery with the exception of the punishment for a crime. Mm-hmm. States to make money would lease out their convicts to plantations. So basically just give them back their former slaves, this mm-hmm. time renting them out. Mm-hmm. And this system only lasts about, if I can remember, maybe a generation, maybe 30, 40 years before it starts getting challenged in the courts and it gets it basically eradicated and you can't lease out. You can still, you know, basically use them as slave labor, but only for the state. You can't lease them out, which is why the private system now is so troubling because it's another version of convict leasing, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that context is important for people who maybe don't know it. This is something that's about 100 years old, but, and the Texas Monthly article that we were reading was really useful about making it clear that this is an important historical connection that connects mass incarceration today mm-hmm. to the fallout from slavery then.
Right, 100%. Yeah, thanks. I completely forgot to give that context. I think what's important to remember too is just that this parcel of land that they found the victims on tells a really important story. It was obviously originally indigenous land. The Karankwa, I'm not sure if I'm saying that, the Karankwa tribe had originally had claim to this land, and then they were pushed out by Mexico, and then Mexico ceded the land to Stephen Austin, and with a promise, he made a promise, obviously, that he wouldn't enslave people on this land. He did not follow through on that promise, and it became a sugar plantation, which became a sugar plantation that farmed for Imperial Sugar Company, which is a still extant sugar company in Texas, one of the largest sugar companies in the United States. And then it became a plantation that after emancipation employed convict labor to farm sugar. And then the state bought the plantation and farmed it with convict labor through, not through leasing, but through putting prisoners to work, incarcerated men and women to work on their own land, state-owned land, to farm sugar. And as like for additional context, you know, the phrase being sold down the river and the severity of being sold down the river comes from the idea that sugar farming is the most difficult kind of farming that one could do in a state of enslavement or a state of convict labor. Because sugar is a perishable good, much more perishable than cotton or tobacco, the turnaround time for harvesting sugar and processing it is very, very quick. And the physical danger and difficulty of farming sugar mean that the, you know, sugar being involved in sugar production is one of the worst kinds of labor you could do.
Right. One of the things I learned from the Texas Monthly article was that, and this was interesting, I never knew this particular nuance, but sugar industries often would collapse after slavery is eradicated in certain areas because no one will do it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such hard work, you can't find someone who will accept money to do it. Like, it's so hard. Mm-hmm. So they have to implement slavery or no one's going to do it. I mean, the same thing happened in Cuba, right? Except, mm-hmm. you know, it's there, it's kind of different names depending on which regime, but ultimately you're just forcing someone to harvest the sugar.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, what's really sad about the lack of historical memory we have about convict labor is that it affected far more people than, you know, an institution like lynching, right? Hundreds of thousands of men and women were incarcerated and put to work in this system. And, you know, there are historians like Talitha LaForia and Sarah Haley are written books about women's involvement in this system, the sexual assault that they were subjected to, and then the infanticide that their children were subjected to so that they could continue to work on sugar plantations.
You're going to have to give us a reading list for me to tweet out later.
It's extensive. It's getting renewed attention, I would say, in the last 5 years, precisely because we're treading on ground where bones are buried, right?
Literal and figurative.
Yeah.
Hey, and shouts to Reggie Moore for not letting this go. Like, when I read that, I didn't realize, like, when I this story came across my timeline, and then, Joe, I want to hear from you after this. This story came across my timeline because I heard about the unmarked graves, right? Mm-hmm. And then I heard about the guy who found him. What I learned today was this guy's been working on this since like 17, 18 years now. Mm-hmm. So fucking big ups to Reggie Moore for not letting it go.
Yeah.
Joe, you've been wanting to talk about this for a while. Why don't you speak on it?
Well, because I learned about this just doing market research, because I'm supposed to, you know, I'm a salesperson. I know my area, what's going on in the area. So when the bodies were found and the school board is going through the battle of what to do with them. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to move them from this site, bury them someone else. And they're like, no, we need to make this, preserve this. We need to make this a record. Like, we need to keep their mm-hmm. bodies there. Reading about this, because I wasn't familiar with convict slavery, not as familiar. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew it existed, but just how brutal it is. Like, we talk mm-hmm. about how brutal it is to get sugar. They weren't treated. It's sort of sad. They weren't treated with the same respect that slaves were, because at the end of the day, slaves were treated as property. Mm. These men weren't property. A lot of these people died from just straight exhaustion. They just worked them as much as they could until they stopped breathing. Was really how brutal this was. So when you think about these 95 people, these 95 bodies we found, it's just a small fraction of how many people went through this brutal thing mm-hmm. that, again, America refuses to really talk about because it paints us in a bad light. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk more about like the battle that's been going on. It looks like the battle is pretty much over now, but the school board really wanted to get these bodies out of there and proceed like business as usual and just get mm-hmm. the school up. Mm-hmm. And people have really rallied around, no, we need to preserve this. We need to make mm-hmm. a record here, which has been very uplifting.
Right. Well, it seems like, I mean, you know more about the Sugarland area than I do, yeah. Joe, but it mm-hmm. seems like from Reggie's perspective, you know, when I had a chance to speak with him, mm-hmm. there's a lot of internal struggle in Sugarland, you know, yes. which is also a rapidly gentrifying area that sees itself as diverse, but that maybe isn't so socioeconomically diverse.
I will say this. So Fort Bend County is the most diverse county in America. But included in Fort Bend County is Stafford, Texas, Missouri City, Texas, Sugarland, Texas. So Sugarland is the gentrified part. Sugarland mm-hmm. is the one with all the money. It's the other outside communities where the minorities live. Right. And sort of where I work in Stafford, technically. But we're right on the line of Stafford and Sugarland. So I get everything. And our Chinatown is right down the street. So we have huge, and we call it Chinatown, but it's a huge Vietnamese population just because that's how racism works.
Sorry, that laugh was brought to you by Glenn Finish, Kane. That's what I'm thinking.
But this, so yes, this area is diverse, but it's also segmented by cities. So it's sort of like that's those are the dividing lines. Like if you live in Stafford, most likely you're going to be black. If you live in Missouri City, most likely you're going to be black or Eastern Asian or Western Asian. Rather,
I used to work in a call center on that border, like right that border, right on the other side of what is it? Not the belt, past that, like right on that border. Right?
Yeah.
I forget what that interchange is. I used to work right there at a call center, and when I would pull up it's just for some context, you know, I'm working at a call center, so I got to use my white voice, right? So
code switching.
Right. So when I would see the address of the person calling me, because I could pull up the record, right? Because I was like the manager. I'm the guy, I was the designated getting yelled at guy, right? So if the address was from Stafford, I'm going to be like, this person's already pissed because they assume I'm white and they assume that I don't like them. So they're defensive immediately because that's probably been their experience. And if the address was from, Sugar Land, then I know that it doesn't matter what my race is because this person is rich and pissed off that their thing wasn't there on time, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But it did give me a clue because it's so gentrified out there of what kind of yell that I'm about to get.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's like, you know, talking to Reggie, it's like, well, he's an old school activist, you know, like he is about relationship building and coalition building. And once he knows who you are, you're going to get a phone call from him to do something for him and for the project immediately. Cause he's just a really good coalition builder. But I think, you know, managing the politics of Fort Bend School District and the politics of Sugar Land and the politics of Houston, he's been really smart to get a lot of institutions on his side to try to figure out, you know, do the bodies need to be disinterred? Can't they be buried where they were found? There's another cemetery that was a marked cemetery that they could be moved to. But this is, the way he speaks about it is like, this is an opportunity, right? This is an opportunity to build a memorial akin to what's in Montgomery. This is an opportunity to build a museum, to have a public education program. You're already building a school. This is a perfect fit for education, right? Public education surrounding this issue. And he doesn't get paid for this. Right. He's retired. His wife would prefer that he not, you know, that he take a step back and let somebody else take the lead. But for him, this is like a calling, you know, and, you know, I had heard great things about him. I think when I met him, I was just, you know, all of that was surpassed just by the enormity of the project that he's taken on his shoulders, how much time and care he puts and thoughtfulness he puts into it. And the fact that he's entirely self-trained as an activist and a historian, which is really fucking impressive.
Right. No, when I was reading that Texas Monthly article, it was called Blood and Sugar. If you're listening, it's really good. Maria recommended it before and I found it again and it was really great. One of the big takeaways is like, God dang, this dude is a fucking hero. Like I was so inspired. Like just old school, like not giving a fuck, not giving in, man. Like if I've learned anything, as you know, because you've helped me, I've researched the civil rights era. And the one thing I've learned, if nothing else, it doesn't take a lot of people. It just takes a few people who just are going to will this over.
Right.
Because that's just what works. And like, that's what Reggie's doing. It must be so gratifying for him to see this be a conversation in his lifetime, you know, because we never listen to prophets in their lifetime. But here we are, man.
Yeah. And I think just the fact that so many academic historians who have jobs in universities are organizing conversations where he's the keynote speaker, right?
Must
also be really gratifying because he's the person on the ground doing the work. And I think, ideally in an academic scenario, that's what our research does, right? It advances the work of people like Reggie who are doing what they're doing as so much more immediate and urgent and its consequences and implications.
I just think if you're unfamiliar with it, please read. Like, Jorge, you're going to post the links?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to do like please a reading list.
I've mostly been reading the Fort Bend Star. They've been covering it a lot. But just, this is, I'm glad we have a platform to get more of this story out.
So what's happening with it now? The last thing I saw was that they were, that Reggie was, you know, fighting with the council, the city council, about, you know, what, putting a memorial up or building a museum or something. Mm-hmm. And they mostly just listened politely and then were like, all right, next thing.
Do you know where
things are now?
I think it's tied up in a lot of legal challenges. So I think the school district basically said, we don't want to do something here, but you can have the bodies, right? Reggie and his attorneys, you know, he's got this team of attorneys that have volunteered, obviously, to work on this project, I think are mounting a kind of legal case to get an injunction from doing anything before a full survey and research has been done about what to do next. Like, this needs to be a community decision, where the community comes to grips to it and a full scale research is done. And if that means that building the school takes longer, then that means building the school takes longer, right? This project takes precedence over a new school for what it sounds like are already kind of overprivileged kids.
Has there been a please won't someone think of the children moment? The kids need their school. Like,
not that I've paid attention to, but I'm pretty good at filtering out that kind of modulation of tone. I mean, Reggie is definitely fighting the good fight. And he's, you know, like I said, he's like very old school in the way that he builds consensus, you know, like he is firm in his position, but he also will keep knocking on your door until you say yes. He's not a kind of person that creates enemies. He is, I have every belief that he will be successful in really fulfilling this opportunity to do a kind of public education and public memorial program.
Awesome, man. If I ever get down to Houston again, I'll look forward to being one of his soldiers.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, he'll knock down your door. Yeah.
Hey, I'll do it. I'll do it. Like I don't know if I'm going to be perfectly honest about who I am as a person. Like, I've always seen myself as a lone wolf, but I don't really think of myself as a leader. But I am now ready to be like I don't know, a captain, right?
Yeah.
Under a general, I think I'd enjoy that.
Yeah.
This man sounds worthy, or at least his cause is worthy. It doesn't really have to be about the person, right? If civil rights taught me anything else, it's not about the person, it's about the cause.
I'm going down to Louisiana, honey, behind the sun. You know, I just find out my trouble just begun.
Okay, so anyway, because you mentioned the museum in D.C., the African American History Museum. Have you been?
Yeah, I just got a chance to go in March when I was in D.C., and it was my first time there, and I was just, you know, absolutely overwhelmed and floored at what an achievement it is to have put that together.
This is your first time in DC or your first time?
My first time at the museum.
Okay.
I hadn't been to DC since it had opened, and they're still doing time passes because it's such a popular of the Smithsonian's, a very popular museum. And yeah, it was really, really well done. A lot of really stunning artifacts. They sort of take you through, you know, a history of Black oppression, right, on three floors. And then they have also like Black cultural arts and achievements.
Right on.
But it takes a good, I would break it up into 2 4-to-5-hour days to really be able to cover everything. There's a lot.
Wow, it's that big.
Yeah, it's huge.
That's impressive.
And really, really well done. So it's worth, I think they give the time passes like a month in advance. So it's worth following them on Twitter and making sure that you get your passes if you're going to be in DC.
I'm going to have to, you know, look into that. The first time I went to D.C. and I spent a whole day just on the Smithsonian Mall just checking out museums. So I'm a big museum head. And it's the first time in my life I've ever been like, I'm glad I pay taxes.
Right. Yeah.
That feeling before.
Yeah. No, it's really impressive.
But what was interesting about this is what you were saying earlier, you know, going transitioning to not just this, but the whole memorial thing we've been talking about generally, is you had mentioned in the chat about Louisiana and civil rights tourism,
mm-hmm.
which today I learned that civil rights tourism is a thing. And it's what it sounds like. It's people planning vacations around going to civil rights museums.
Yeah.
And my first immediate thought was like, that feels like a weird vacation. And then I started seeing some of the actual museums across the state and mm-hmm. across the states, especially across the mm-hmm. south. I was like, oh dang, am I gonna have to book a trip to fucking Alabama? Like, some of these are great, some of them sound really good.
And
so it really made me conflicted. But the idea of tourism to civil rights museums is interesting. So, but Louisiana sounds like it's really resisting having any kind of civil rights anything. Because when we tell the civil rights story, Louisiana sort of skates, right?
Sort of
go Georgia to Mississippi, and like, that's kind of enough. Y'all get it.
So right. States
that are implicated are just sort of like hanging back, not saying anything too loud. So no one mentions their name, but they're fucking shitty too, obviously.
Well, Louisiana has so many important historical sites for especially Black activism. Like Congo Square in New Orleans is like a really important historical site. But it, you know, Louisiana has a strange relationship with its history. You know, when I moved here, a lot of my students would tell me that people, white people, get married on plantations here.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge thing.
And like with no acknowledgement of the historical context of that site.
Dude, you remember Paula Deen? Remember what Paula Deen did? She was catering weddings on plantations of all Black staff.
So it's like, you know, that's hugely problematic. So I guess like in terms of tourism, right, there's sort of two, I mean, there's more than two, but in my mind, there's like historically responsible civil rights tourism. And then there's historically irresponsible tourism, right? And so most of Louisiana's plantations are about how white people lived, right? And not that white people were enslavers. They're like, look at this beautifully large Gone with the Wind style house, right?
That's somehow more offensive to me. Not that they're erasing slavery so much as just like, but weren't the dresses nice?
Right. No, it's a total reinforcement of the sort of Old South narrative that gets pushed, you know, when Confederate monuments are being built after the Civil War. That's like, those two things go side by side because that mythology is this, that ethos is the same. So that's, I would say in Louisiana, that's much more the kind of tourism we have, is like white people that want to see white people, white supremacist stuff. But there are a couple of responsible sites, you know, Congo Square, there are some markers, you have to look to find them, but you can, and they're responsibly written and placed. There is the Whitney Plantation, which is actually really well done and is about the history of slavery in South Louisiana. And would be the only plantation I think I would recommend to visit in the state of Louisiana. And I mean, there are tons of artists and activists doing really cool stuff. There's going to be a reenactment of a rebellion, an enslaved people's rebellion in Louisiana by this artist called Dred Scott in next year. So there's
Wait, the artist called named himself Dred Scott?
Yeah, it's Dread.
I hope he's not taking 3/5 of what he's owed.
His art is really good. You should look him up, dredscott.com. I saw him give a talk recently. So there are, I mean, obviously, you know, Black communities in South Louisiana are making sure that responsible tourism sites get built. But it, you know, I've heard a rumor recently, and I'm not sure that I can find anything that verifies that it's true, that Louisiana is sort of jealous of the tourism dollars that Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia are getting from responsible historical tourism sites, and they'd like to dole out some money so that they can get some of those dollars too.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I learned some things today, you know, researching civil rights tourism. And my research, I mean the two articles that I read.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I learned was that Louisiana actually had a civil rights museum approved to be funded by the state, like in 1997 or 1998, something like that, which would have made it the first one in the nation. But they just dragged their feet on it. They just keep finding reasons not to build it. And now you see all these other places building them and making a ton of money, right? Like African Americans alone are generating like in the billions, right? Traveling to Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Alabama, of all places, has like both the richest collection of civil rights tourism and like responsible sites, which I was crazy to learn. And also generating the most money from them. Probably their only source of money, because what other reasons are there to go to Alabama, you know?
Yeah, not a lot.
It makes sense for Alabama to be able to profit off racism.
That's the thing. That's the thing I was thinking. Like, I feel weird that they're profiting off of it.
Yeah.
Good to me. And then I thought, but I'm also mad that Louisiana won't profit off of it. And you can't always, like, you can't get too caught up in, like, capitalism makes everything shitty. Because, like, that's, and water's wet. You can do that forever, right?
I mean, there is something to be said, I think. You know, so it's been weird living in the South, and I'm sure you guys experience this, but I'm not from the South. You know, like, when people shit on the South on Twitter or whatever, I'm like, you live in a state where there are literally no people of color, so, like, get off my jock. You know what I mean? Like, you might be talking about, like, white people in the state of Louisiana. I agree with you, but we have a really, really large non-white population in Louisiana, and you really can't say the same, New Hampshire, you know? So it's like... You know, like, so
random New Hampshire slam.
Right? Or like whatever, you know, it's just like, there are people of color and black people specifically in Louisiana that should profit from the historical structures of oppression that the state has used against them. It's just like, how do we find a way to get that money in those hands, you know, and not in Louisiana's hands so that they use it for things like restricting people's access to birth control.
I like how you frame that in like black people should get to profit off their own pain, because I lost my father when I was 19, and I've used that fact to get laid so many times that I would be a hypocrite. I would be a hypocrite to deny somebody else their version of that. I'm making an equivalency here. I realize that I shouldn't have, but you know, it's too late.
Who are these ladies?
Oh, bro, grad students just bust just like, out.
Oh, your dad died.
I could tell some stories.
You want to hear my overly modern poem about it? They sure do. The answer is always yes. That train is never late.
Oh my God.
Where were we? Oh, so okay. So the profiting off the thing, racism. And if ever I was gonna drop my problematic dating habits in this, it's in this conversation, right? Racism is like my ugly friend right now.
I'm going down in New Orleans. Get me a mojo hand. I'm going down in New Orleans. Get me a mojo hang.
Oh, take me with you, man, when you go.
So much of this, the politics of this obviously are protecting this narrative of white exceptionalism, right? That, you know, forgetting the ugly parts, focusing on the good parts and the sort of erasure that comes with it. And there's, of course, the thing that, as much as I love what you said about the South also struggles in places. This isn't universal. I like to think Houston is in many ways an exception, although not unproblematic, but an exception in the sense that certain Southerners will never see black Southerners in particular, but people of color generally, as their kin, right? Those aren't Americans, right? That's not the narrative of America we're purporting, which sites of memorialization always do. They offer a narrative of history, right, of what deserves to be remembered. And on the other hand, there's money to be made. So if you see like these like white supremacist counter impulses protecting the sanctity of white exceptionalism, but also making a buck. And I had this moment when I was reading Louisiana, it's just refusing to like against, like, obviously this would be good for your state. Like, you get some good museums, you increase some tourism, you increase tax dollars. It is mutually beneficial to everyone on some level. And even though I agree with your point, like, make sure this money goes to the people who could use it better than the people, you know, that shouldn't. But there is some level of rising tides raise all boats logic to it, right?
So,
I know, it's interesting, but yeah.
My answer to that question, I guess, is always like, rising tides raise all boats is always racist.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Because
absolutely.
If reparations aren't explicitly racially targeted, we'll find a way to use them to further white supremacy, right? Like, that's the problem with most of the policies that get enacted in the 1990s.
You're going to do reparations as a bunch of Amazon gift cards, so we just have to hand the money right back.
Right. Well, and I mean, like, it's interesting. I mean, not to like dive into another topic, but I heard one of the Georgetown descendants speak recently about sort of what Georgetown is offering the people descended from the enslaved people that Georgetown sold to save the university. And, you know, they're very divided. The descendants are very divided on whether reparations, how, whether taking reparations from Georgetown for them specifically is enough in terms of like grappling with slavery as an institution writ large, right? So they feel almost as if like they shouldn't be singled out for reparations because we can trace this particular historical narrative, but like all Black people, right, should be beneficiaries of a larger program from Georgetown that shouldn't just target the people that are directly descended from the people that were sold. So yeah, it is this question of like, how do you do history responsibly? How do you fund it? How do you profit from it? And then what are the implications of how you decide all of those questions? And thank God I'm not a public historian, so I don't have to answer them. I just get to ask questions, not answer them.
Joe, you've been nodding your head for a while. You want to speak on this?
Louisiana is interesting to me because I have such a tie to it. Like, both my parts of my family, my dad's family is from central Louisiana, and my mom's family is from north of New Orleans, Louisiana. And so you see me, I'm an African-American person, but I look very light-skinned, and it's part of the one drop rule of Louisiana. My dad's family is all Creole. I would assume their history probably goes more to the Cachada tribe because they're from Elton, Louisiana. But Louisiana racism is definitely a big part of my life. And Louisiana is always interesting to me because of how they won't do this. And it's also very, how can I put it? It's one of the reddest states we have, and we never talk about how red Louisiana is. And it's mostly because of gentrification, voter disenfranchisement, just all these different tactics of the oppressors. Like, Louisiana is like prime example number one of all of that.
Man, they're fucking police, man. They're rough out there.
Yeah. Oh, man, they're rough. They're awful. You don't have to be convicted by the entire jury to go to prison in Louisiana. It just takes a majority.
What the fuck? Are you serious?
So
it's not a majority. It's 10 out of 12. And that was just recently a ballot measure, actually. We can talk a little bit about that if you want. So in the most recent election, they put on the ballot that you would need to be convicted by a unanimous 12-person jury. And I believe that measure passed. I don't know if it has to go through more steps.
Hold on. Take a step back. So the ballot measure did what? I'm sorry. I'm still reeling over the finding out that you get convicted with 10 out of 12.
I think it's 10 out of 12 or 11 out of 12. It's that's a Jim Crow era rule, post 13th Amendment.
So, and the new one is getting rid of it.
The new one is getting rid of it, yeah. And I believe that measure passed in large part because of a pretty well-funded grassroots movement in New Orleans that got out the vote for that measure, that ballot measure specifically. It was Prop 2, I think.
So you're telling me Louisiana didn't just start acting right?
No. I mean, if you you know, I've had a lot of students who are criminal justice, interested in criminal justice, who have toured Angola. I've not been there myself. You may know that they do a prison rodeo at Angola every year that the public can come and see. So Louisiana, yeah, has a real fucked up sense of criminal justice, in addition to probably the largest or second largest carceral state
in the nation.
So yeah, the ballot measure, I mean, was really important effort, you know, just talking to public defenders here, like, you know, if all it takes is one or two holdouts, like, that's a pretty easy bar for DAs to clear, leads to a lot of wrongful convictions.
Yeah, I bet it does. Mm-hmm. Christ.
We have a Democratic governor now, but he's a Louisiana Democrat, right? So he's basically like a centrist Republican.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've said on here before, being a centrist Democrat is just being a Republican who doesn't like racism.
Right, yeah. Right. And like in Louisiana, doesn't like racism out loud, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And even though you got to cloak it in this sort of like, for your own goodness, like, I just, somebody, people are, you know, digging up receipts on Biden right now, who's only tangentially related, but he said something about how Iowa schools do better than Florida schools. They don't have, because they don't have black people. Like,
yeah.
Oh, and it was like, and it's sort of like Moynihan turn, like, it's not their fault. They don't have dads. Like, ah, you know, it's right, so fucking right, frustrating.
Right. Well, yeah. And I mean, Obama fell into that trap a little bit too, right? I mean, it's like it's pernicious. Like, these structural problems, the way we try to explain them away is dangerous, because our, you know, I find in the classroom, and I think it for the general public, thinking about individual people as racist or not racist is the easiest explanation for what's happening, but it's not the best explanation for what's happening.
Right. No. Whenever we talk about race in my classrooms, the first thing I do is like, we're not here to talk about racists. Like, who gives a shit about one racist? Like, we're here to talk about racism.
Right.
Structures and institutions. Yeah. Like, and I say, and I always just say, like, look, we're not here to assign blame, but all of us are responsible because this needs to be fixed, right? We all live here. Like, it doesn't matter who broke the toilet. We need to fix the toilet.
Right. Yeah. The toilet being the United States of America.
Right. Because we're fucking shit right now, and it's overflowing, and we got to get rid of it.
Yeah, I know. It's so tough. It's, you know, it's one of the most rewarding places to teach, I think, in the country. But it is, like, it was a true culture shock when I got here, for sure.
I want to show all you good-looking women just how to treat your man. Let's go back to New Orleans, boys.
Both of you are busy, so we're going to go ahead and move us on to our last topic.
Yeah.
You said that you were – one of the reasons we started talking about this at all is because you and me, we keep in touch, and you were telling me about the efforts in Louisiana to establish a lynching memorial of some kind. Yeah. I found out there's actually like a big lynching museum that's highly reputable. Is it? I want to say it's in Jackson. Did I remember that correctly?
It's in Montgomery.
Montgomery. Alabama, mm-hmm. Again. Fucking Alabama.
Yeah.
So, we might have to give Louisiana, Alabama's seat on the
right. Brian Stevenson, who is a guy who's been involved with something akin to the Innocence Project, right, of trying to get people wrongfully convicted out of prison and out of bad carceral circumstances for years, got interested, you know, like, his story is very akin to Reggie Moore's. He got interested in the history of lynching in the United States, especially because of the 13th Amendment and sort of extra legal mechanisms for punishment, built this museum and memorial in Montgomery. And if you, which if you have the opportunity to go, should absolutely go and visit. It's really stunning and a really sobering experience to walk through the memorial itself.
You know, you drive to Texas, which I haven't done in a while, when I drive to Texas, and I did this with Matt the last time we were driving down, we actually tried to make it through Alabama and Mississippi without stopping on one tank of gas. This time I might stop in Montgomery.
Yeah, no, and if you go, let me know, because there's like two good restaurants and that's it, and I'll tell you what they are. Mm-hmm. But it's the memorial itself is like part of what the memorial is trying to do is to start a kind of social justice movement. So he has asked every parish and county in the South that has victims of lynching to form a coalition within their county or parish to establish, to bring a marker listing their victims from Montgomery to their county, an identical marker, a marker that replicates the one that hangs in Montgomery. Hmm. So I've been working with a community group here to bring our marker from Montgomery and to do a project that honors the six victims in our parish. And that's been a lot of fun. I've been working with retired people, students, I mean, all ages. And we've been doing research on our six victims in county courthouses, on microfilm at LSU, in a ton of different places to try to bring the project here. So we've just recently gotten our partnership approved by the Equal Justice Initiative, which is Brian Stevenson's group that works out of Montgomery. And now the next step is trying to figure out how to negotiate with the city to place the markers and getting approval to do that. And luckily at the helm, we have a very competent man akin to Reggie and Brian Stevenson, who has been working in the community on social justice issues for a while, was part of the March on Washington and has a lot of good relationships. So it's just kind of about massaging that, as well as community attitudes. We had a big uproar over a drag queen story hour that was going to be held at our public library a couple of weeks ago that nobody expected. It sort of just came out of nowhere. So we're sort of preparing for backlash because, you know, part of this group has also been working on taking down the Confederate monument in our downtown area. So
I have a lot of questions, but I want to give Joe a chance to speak on this first. Joe, you got anything to ask?
No, go for it. No.
All right. So here's my questions immediately as you are hearing you describe that. First of all, you mentioned the Confederate Memorial. Are these two things like tethered? Is one replacing the other, or is it just the same people working on two separate issues?
It's just the same people working on two separate issues. I think it's smart not to tether them. It's just strategic not to tether them.
I imagine at some point somebody's going to, right? Someone's going to realize it's the same people working on two things. So the memorial itself, you were mentioning the markers. I've never been to the Lynching mm-hmm. Memorial Museum, so I don't know. Like, what exactly are you envisioning? Like, where would it be placed? Are you talking like a plaque, a statue, a building?
So,
like, what are we talking?
If you Google Equal Justice Initiative Memorial, you'll probably get a good sense of what they look like. But there are these kind of long columns that look almost like they're like the shape and size of like a basic wooden casket, right? But Whoa. They're made out of metal. They're kind of they've got like a copper tone to them. And then the name of the parish is listed or county, and then the name of each victim and their date of death. And so these, when you go into the memorial, you sort of enter at the same level and they're sort of just standing on the ground. And then as you go into the memorial, you go down and the memorials start to go up. So then they're hanging above you. And I mean, they're hanging to sort of replicate
right.
what looking up at a lynching victim would look like, right? So the sort of visceral experience of the memorial is very intense. But so there's an exact replica of each of those boxes for each county that they want to move. And then in addition to that, they want a historical marker. And we applied for six, one for each of our victims, with actual words honoring those victims and their circumstances. And we can place those together. We can place them apart. We still have to kind of make decisions, I think, based on our negotiation with the city,
work. Have they been receptive to it? Like, is it seemed like it's going to happen, or?
I think there are some workarounds and there are talks happening. You know, part of the question always is, I think, with this kind of memorial is like, do you put it in a high traffic location or do you put it in a kind of symbolically meaningful location? Do you want the location to be peaceful? Do you want the location to be meditative? Do you want it to be like, what do you want the, you know, I guess like that's why there are professionals that do this thing and it's not what I do, right? But there are professionals that design memorials with the intention of what is the user's experience, right? And so we've been able to actually locate the site of a couple of lynchings pretty almost exactly.
Wow.
And so they're mostly on privately owned land, but we could find some public land close to that private land and put the marker on the site that the murder happened. But it's if it's not a well-tread site, is that a meaningful location, right? So these are the kind of conversations we're having as we move through the next steps.
Right on. Well, once you get your GoFundMe up, because the state's not giving y'all any
money. Yeah. We will definitely have a GoFundMe, and yeah. I will send it to you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That's killer, though. I have, I guess, one last question. In regards to, I guess, sort of this generally, maybe specifically, I'll let you decide how to answer the question, but I'm just thinking about this lynching museum, which again I found out exists like 2 hours ago, you know,
right?
It just never occurred to me that someone would be like that, because as you know, the thing I was working on this summer, you read a couple drafts. Mm-hmm. I had to research lynching and its history, and it's just, you know, every bit is horrifying. And I honestly did like, I'm not gonna say I did the bare minimum, but I did as much as I could stomach, right? Like that was the hardest thing I ever had to work on, like, because you get to look at the images and like I was legit having trouble sleeping. You can ask my wife, like, I was legit like having nightmares. It's just nightmare stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the controversies I found was about how do you memorialize this without recreating the gaze? And you mentioned how you're supposed to sort of symbolically looking up, so you sort of know what it feels like. How do you navigate that sort of like visceral visual politics? Because on the one hand, you don't want to forget. On the other hand, looking feels like, but maybe you should feel that way. But then are you just putting out bodies for display again? And yeah. I remember, like, I'm glad I don't have to decide this debate, right? Because even within like African American scholars, it's so split about what is appropriate and what is useful. So I mean, how do you feel about like how do you navigate that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think it like probably I have more questions than answers again, but I think when you were writing that chapter, I ended up sending you Ken Gonzalez Day's Erased series referencing it. Mm-hmm. Which I think he's a visual artist and also a historian. And he created this series of, he altered a series of lynching photographs where he removed the body of the victim but kept the crowd. And so your eye is drawn to the crowd as the focal center of the photograph. And so what would it mean if we turned our voyeurism there, or if we turned our critical gaze there rather than, because part of, I think, his point, and I don't want to overread the art, but I think part of his point is we don't need to see the lynched body to know that the lynched body exists.
Right? This is weirdly like everything Louisiana's ever wanted, right? We're erasing Black people from history and just leaving y'all. This is what y'all want, right?
Right. I mean, in some ways, like, and I think that part of what you're pointing to is like where you kind of have to meet your audience where it is, right? So if your audience isn't willing to admit that racism exists, right, or white supremacy exists, or lynching was a phenomenon that happened, then erasing the body has real implications, right? But if you're speaking to a Black community that's inscribed on the Southern landscape in really particular ways, and that feels the trauma of that, and doesn't want to have nightmares about that body, right? I mean, you're grappling with two very different communities, with two very different conceptions of U.S. history and history in South Louisiana. Like most, for the victims that we were able to trace in my parish, for the actual perpetrators that were named, their name, famous Cajun names, right? Their names that people, we have streets and buildings and parks after, right? So these people were prominent community members, right? And that's the case in most lynchings. So I think, you know, if that story gets told, there are going to be some white Cajun people that aren't happy, right? Because their family is going to be implicated in this crime. That's that's kind of tough, right? I mean, that's how it goes.
Yeah. You brought up the Georgetown thing. And the first thing I thought of, like, man, all y'all is doing is reputation laundering. That's what y'all are doing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's, at least for the descendant that I spoke with, I think that's her sort of point of view too, right? If this reparation only lasts a generation, then it won't have mattered at all. Right? Yeah. Generational wealth is about accumulation over a long period of time. And so is trauma. And so the longer we wait to grapple with these things, the harder it will be.
I will say it feels like we're talking about it more now than we ever have.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. What do you guys think about that? Am I grasping at straws, or is that really true? I mean, I can't remember. If you told me there would be movements built around pulling down Confederate statues, I never would have believed you growing up in the South.
Hmm.
Just that on its own is, to me, it feels significant. If nothing else, that there's an opportunity here, that we're having this sort of moment of rupture where, like, the dam is breaking, right? Who knows what will happen? I'm not suggesting that we're going to have historical closure anytime soon.
Right.
But the fact that I don't know, the fact that I think...
I think it's harder to oppress these voices now, but I also think we're getting them amplified because... We live in a world where that's built on an obsession with rage and being offended. Mm. So I think it's a little bit of both. So you have the voices who are trying to take these symbols down, but you also have a media that's going to make money off of the outrage against taking those symbols down. So the oppressed are getting a bigger voice because the oppressors want to piss off you. So I think that's a little bit, I think it's working in the favor of these things are happening more now. But I also think it's still a part of the system. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, so they want to take down these Confederate statues. Well, yeah, I'm pissed off about it. And so we get Charlottesville, we get all these things, and it really rallies the base of the oppressors.
Yeah.
So I think it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Like, these moments become moments of consolidation of white supremacy as much as they are resistance. And I think, I mean, in the long view, I think I've just become more and more enamored with Afro-pessimism. You know, it's like, we can struggle, but it's not, but the system is fucked, right? Like,
yeah.
Doesn't mean I'm not an activist in my everyday life. It just means that I don't have a lot of hope that removing symbols is going to change the structure, which isn't to say that the symbols aren't important, because of course they are, but just to say that we're a long way from justice or something that looks like freedom.
Well, I mean, good point. And it's especially to undercut my own point, but what you said, like, tearing down a bunch of statues isn't going to get us free, right? It can be symbolically satisfying, and I want to read it as an element of a sea change. But it's also the dark version of that is that we're just settling for low-hanging fruit, right?
Right, because the state isn't going to save us, right? I think you have to I don't want to be like a full-blown anarchist, but I think you have to reject the U.S. state in order to be able to go anywhere with what freedom actually looks like. It can't be freedom under a liberal democracy. That doesn't exist.
I mean, Malcolm had it right, right? We got to build, you got to start building up alternative institutions, right?
Yeah.
You don't make the world a better place. You make yourself better at dealing with the world. At least as a first step.
Right. Yeah.
Well, right on. On that note, I'm going to finish this. Joe, you want the last word?
Oh, no, thank you so much for coming on. I love that this conversation. Please come on again.
Yeah, for sure.
We have been trying to plan, for those of you out there, we had originally planned this as our Mardi Gras pod, you know?
we were talking about Mardi Gras.
Yeah, and then shit happened, and we kept pushing it back, and... Yeah. But we've been committed to this pod. I was afraid we were going to lose you, that you're like, oh, they don't really want to do it. Like, no, we've been trying to have this conversation for a while.
Like a mess.
Yeah. No, but that next year's Mardi Gras for sure. We'll do it. And between now and then, I'm sure there'll be some kind of crazy film we should discuss.
There you go.
Oh my gosh. Have you guys talked about Us yet? Jordan Peele's new film?
I haven't seen it, man. I'm sorry.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Go see it, Jorge, in that.
All right. We'll see. Chat. I'll see Us and then we'll have another talk. All right.
Yeah. For sure.
All right, homies. Well, peace out, Maria. Thanks for joining us. Maria, you're the shit. You always have been. You've always been an inspiration, and that has not changed.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys.
Thank you.
Y'all
keep
take
fighting the fight.
Yeah, right on. And, hey, you need soldiers. You got our numbers.
Great.
All right. Take it easy.
See ya.
I'm going down in Louisiana, baby, behind the sun.